From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Goal Own Goal. Joining me, as always, from the lake, or by the lake, or near the lake, or sometimes in the lake, who knows, Roger Mitchell. Rog, hello, my friend. How the bloody hell are you?
Yeah, well, it's early. It's an early podcast today for both of us, so we're in the bed still more than in the lake. Slightly tired, slightly low-key, but let's see if it remains low-key. I wanted to ask you, Grant, tell me a little bit about your travels. I want to start with something that will get you going a little bit, you know. So you're at this a couple of big conferences in the West Coast with Jawad and things like that. Tell me a little bit. I'm prompted by Ross Gerber's tweet. Tell me a little bit about what the sentiment is in the sane world, Grant. Oh, what is going on in the world? I can't believe the Ross Gerber tweet. I told you so.
I would expect you to see Duncan's horses eat each other before I saw anything like that. But if there's anyone not paying attention or not following this, we're talking about Tesla and one of the famous staunch supporters of Tesla who has defended the company and Elon to the hilt and made something of a name for himself. And he's come out this week with the stock down 50% this year, talking about how he's been warning everybody how bad things are.
You can hardly say it. You can't
write this stuff. I mean, it's extraordinary. And, you know, it's funny, Rich, we saw that. I mean, this is a sports podcast, but we might as well.
We'll get into it. Let me go with the flow. Trust me.
We saw last night the first quarter results come out, which were abysmal. I mean, I cannot even tell you how bad the results were last night on every possible level, except the fact that once again, the charlatan has dangled a few more dreams in front of people about robo-taxis and all this nonsense.
Cybertrucks.
I mean, we're back there again. And the stock was up, I think, 10 or 12% after hours. And I cannot even tell you how bad these results were. They were shocking on every possible level, except the dream. And, the stock's down a long way, so I guess it makes sense. But if ever a bounce was going to fade, I suspect it's going to be this one. So, again, it's going to be interesting to watch what happens
next.
But
did they not have to recall all the Cybertrucks because of the soap on the brake pedal or something?
They announced a recall for every Cybertruck sold, which turns out to only be 400,000, despite them having apparently millions of orders. And they're being Cybertrucks parked up in the inventory and in the Tesla facilities that make a great aerial drone shot, hundreds of them upon hundreds of them. They had to recall all 400,000 of them because someone had been using soap to help attach the plastic pad to the accelerator pedal. I mean, I don't know what to say anymore about this thing. It's funny, you know, Franz and I were traveling and he was asking about this stuff. And I said to him, look, you know, for me, I don't care about Tesla. The only thing that is, it's not even satisfying, it's comforting to me when you see stock like Tesla going down, is that it renders 40 years of accumulated knowledge no longer obsolete, right? The stuff that hasn't seemed to matter matters again, and it should matter. And so, you know, there's no crowing, there's no spike in the ball. It's just a fact that, okay, good, you know, numbers do mean something. The performance of a business does mean something, and the lack of performance does mean something. So, there's a long way to go in this story, and it's the gift that keeps on giving. And I have no idea what this has to do with sport, but I suspect you're about to tell me.
No, this Sunday's column is going to be about, you know, popular delusion and the madness of crowds. You know, mm-hmm. In sport, the massive delusion around the valuation, the crazy valuation of Tesla, is linked to two things in sport, or three: asset values of franchises, values of broadcast rights, and obviously asset valuations in VC. And that's why I was asking you a little bit, what are the cool kids saying about all this? Because, you know, the everything bubble, which does affect sport, what is the latest zeitgeist amongst the smart boys and girls?
Well, there's a creeping realization that interest rates are going to stay higher for longer, which feeds into everything we talked about in terms of what that means, a higher cost of capital, and what that means for the values of things like sports franchises. So there is this creeping realization that that's going to be the case. The idea that the Fed are going to cut rates 3 or 4 times before the end of this year is now switched to a few people starting to say their next move is going to hike rates. It's going to be to hike rates again, which will be interesting if that happens. But, you know, one thing's for certain, Roger, and I think, you know, we can kind of scratch our heads and laugh about Tesla and stuff at some level, but what it actually means is, you know, financial gravity is reasserting itself. And to your point, that's not going to be good for the Todd Bowleys of the world, who paid what they paid for Chelsea, only to watch that abject nonsense.
We'll come back to that.
I'm sure we will. So yeah, I think this the reassertion of financial gravity is probably the takeaway here, and that absolutely, as we've been saying for several years now, is going to have a profound impact upon the valuation of sports franchises.
Yeah. I've got another thing which is very macro, but you know my whole thing about money, demographics and geopolitics. Macro is how I look at sport. I see another term, you know, this is in a CNBC website. Google terminates 28 employees after multi-city protests. Google terminated 28, according to an internal memo viewed by CNBC, after a series of protests against labor conditions and the company's contract to provide the Israeli government with military cloud computing and AI services. This comes a day after another 9 Google workers were arrested on trespassing charges after staging a sit-in in the company's offices in New York and California, including a protest in Thomas Kurian's office, who is the Google Cloud CEO. This I'm putting under the heading of our spectrum pendulum thing, where I believe it's swinging back. I think, you know, the peak stuff that we got through COVID, where there was an idea that anything goes and whatever you did, you would always have a check from the government to pay for your needs. I think, as you say, gravity is starting to reassert itself. Google, you know, one of the woke poster children, you know, starting to sack people for pissing around.
Yeah, I mean, this idea is everywhere, Rog, at the moment. You know, everywhere you look, we're starting to see normality return. And it's funny, I've been noticing this a lot lately. If you watch stand-up comedians, which I do, they're always at the cutting edge of changes in sentiment. And it's been really interesting to watch in the last 6 months. If you pull up the latest Netflix stand-up special, for example, whoever it may be, you will find in there, I'm pretty sure, not 100%, but a significant number of those comedians will be making jokes about the whole gender issue and all the things that everyone was terrified to say anything about. They're starting to make jokes about. And more importantly, if you listen to the laughs those jokes get, they are way in excess of the quality of the jokes, i.e. people are just relieved that they can laugh at these things again, and relieved that it's okay to make jokes about stuff again. And you know, that, again, to me, is another sign of this pendulum starting to swing back the other way. I certainly hope so.
Well, on that, this was one of my things later. And again, it comes from one of your smart kid community, this time George Wolfe, who, for anybody that doesn't know, is one of the top VCs, guy that came from nothing, real poverty, to be one of the top thinkers, astonishing intellect. He's posted this routine. Is it Bill Barr, the bald comedian, talking about the women?
Bill Burr, yeah, WNBA. Yeah, WNBA. I knew you'd bring this up. I had this on my list there, just in case you didn't.
Well,
yes,
I mean, like,
yes,
so Josh, okay, the comedian thing is, you know, basically the usual stick about, you know, don't complain about low pay when there's nobody at the fucking stadium, this kind of thing. That's fine, it's funny, right, as to your point. But Josh Wolfe, don't blame inequality in pay, blame inequality in demand. And he goes on and on to make a very coherent economic tweet above, You know, like, and this is to your point, Grant, you know, like, you still get it out there. I couldn't believe it. And the record shows that I said I couldn't believe it a couple of years ago when people were throwing around equal pay willy-nilly as if it was some kind of moral right, completely ignoring the laws of economics on the altar of culture warfare. And as I said, I think we'll call this episode the episode of Gravity Returns, because as you say, enough's enough. Enough's enough, mate.
Well, look, you know, Josh's point and the point Bill Burr is making in a very humorous way, and it is a great clip. We'll have to send that out.
I'll send
that from the
You
Not Entertained Twitter handle. Is that, you know, the attendances just don't support equal pay, right? The TV ratings don't. The attendances live and in person at the games don't. The WNBA, which is the kind of the focus of this because of Caitlin Clark, who we talked about last time out in Goal and Goal, has been going for 25 years now. So it's an established league, and yet the attendance figures are awful, and they've always been awful. And it's not that they're awful, but the size of their audience has self-selected. And it doesn't justify the players getting paid the same as the men do, who bring in, you know, 10 times the revenue and 10 times the TV rights. And that's it, Rog. You know, ultimately, it's sport, as we've said before, is the ultimate meritocracy. And so, you know, trying to mandate equal pay when you're in the business of trying to make money just doesn't make any sense. You know, and it never was sustainable. So, you know, people, I think, are going to have to get okay with the fact that the revenue coming into many women's sports for the time being, because they're in the nascent stage, a lot of them, doesn't justify equal pay. And people are just going to have to get comfortable with that or watch these sports go out of business.
Yeah, one of the other things that will be in this article, I think, this is all under the heading of popular delusion and the madness of crowds, you know, on the same theme.
Your countryman, Charles Mackay.
That's a great shout, man. It's a great shout that you know that. I had to look it up for the article. Good on you, mate.
Oh, come on.
I'm telling you, like...
I've dined off that book for about 20 years,
Rog. Well, the point is everybody should. And, you know, this thing about, you know, welcome to the real world. Women's football in England, which has been a success, the people have talked about crowds and everything. You know, did they get a new TV deal? No, they did not. Sky decided to roll over the current deal for 1 year. You know what I mean? The signals are all around. And this isn't a thing about women and equal pay at all. Sunday's column is going to go into the French league. Let's not talk about it here. Let's leave it for Sunday. The German league. What's going on with DAZN? What's going on with Sky Deutschland losing 300 million? The shit is going to hit the fan, Grant. It's all right there. It's all right there.
Yeah, I think it already is, Roger, and that's the point. And I think for Sky, the smart thing to do is say, right, well, we'll take an option for another year and we'll see. Because if we sign a big contract now and what we're seeing happening continues, we've way overpaid. Why don't we give it another year to bed in and let's see in this age of financial gravity, if we're going to call it that, let's see where the economics stack up. And you know, they've cut the contracts for some of the men's leagues. They haven't cut the Premier League, but that's an outlier.
Well, they did, if you did like for like. They sold a lot more product to keep the same amount. And you know, other little things, you know, all these little signs are all around us for those that want to watch. Fact is, again, that book, most people don't want to watch. Most people want to go with the flow. You know, there was a post this week from the Milwaukee Bucks that said, what happened in 82 games? Nobody really cares, you know? And somebody comes on top of it and says...
It's playoff time.
No, but this isn't the point. Nobody really cares about the regular season, says official team account. And what have I been saying for a long time now? You know, the NBA, by the way, that's the poster child of the next big rights that are coming up, and baseball, I'm telling you, I think there's a non-zero chance they get a major cold shower about broadcasters saying, you know what, in the regular season, I'll take the fourth quarter. I'm not interested in the rest. So, I don't know, something like that. Again, they're not seeing this coming, Grant. Just like they didn't see the French League. They wanted $1 billion for the French League 18 months ago, and now they'll be lucky to get half of that. And if they do get half of it, it's because Macron has pushed his mates in Qatar at BN to oh, anyway, I'll say that on Sunday. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of signs out there and people ain't paying attention. They're still going through the motions like they were 2 years ago on the Kool-Aid. That's this morning's little rant.
Yeah, the NBA is an interesting one, Rog.
Yeah.
The NBA is an interesting one. The NBA is a league that since it was formed in, I think, the 1950s.
Yeah, around
it's,
then.
Actually, before that.
47, actually, something like that.
Before that. But from the 50s onwards, there's always been superstars in the NBA, right? They've always had, back in the day, it was Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell. They've always, you know, in the black and white era and the dominant Boston Celtics. And then, you know, they had this kind of lost period in the 60s and 70s, where the game was struggling. It was, you know, they had a lot of fighting and it just wasn't popular. And then in the 1979 NBA draft, you get Magic Johnson and Larry Bird getting picked by the Lakers and the Celtics. And those two changed the entire fortune of the NBA. You know, they put the whole league on their shoulders and created compelling rivalry. Elevated the sport, elevated everything, and the commissioner, you know, David Stern, did a tremendous job as the commissioner of the NBA, and they managed to create something truly dazzling. And then, of course, along comes Michael Jordan, then Kobe Bryant, and LeBron James, and you were set for 50 years, right? And it's been remarkable. But as those types of superstars leading the league have retired, the new set of superstars, they're just different. Right, they're arguably not less talented, Rog. I mean, you know, for me, Jordan is always going to be at the top of the mountain. Kobe Bryant, a very close second, and then LeBron, third. But these new superstars and the new NBA is very different to the win at all cost mentality of Bird and Johnson and particularly Jordan and particularly Kobe, and that has change the nature of the league. You know, there's a lot more. It's become all about the social media stuff, all about the nonsense. And interestingly, this week we had the LA Lakers, you know, one of the most storied franchises in NBA history, lose a playoff game with LeBron James, you know, at the top of the team. They were 20 points up, and they got beaten by a last second shot by Murray of the Denver Nuggets. And you know, right before that, LeBron misses a three-pointer to win the game. The Nuggets go down the other end, and this young kid, Murray, nails a shot of his own and wins it on the buzzer. Place goes wild. You know, great TV, terrific TV. But the fallout from that afterwards came from LeBron James's press conference, where, you know, he was complaining about not getting the free throws he should get. You know, and ask any NBA fan, and they will tell you that the refs are biased towards the Lakers and have been for years. And the Lakers get way more free throws than anybody else. And it was just this comparison made to
Jordan,
to guys like Jordan and Kobe. You know, saying, I think the tweet I saw was, you know, how many?
Yeah,
do you remember the time when Michael Jordan let 20 point lead slip in the fourth quarter? No, because it didn't effing happen. And it's just this great picture of Jordan like this.
Yeah, I saw that tweet.
And it's true. And it was all about the game. It was all about the game and playing the game, more importantly at that level, winning the game. It wasn't about the social media stuff. It wasn't about, you know, the entertainment side of it. It was about the game. And I think for me, one of the things that I'm hugely hopeful about is that when the money starts to slip away, when the numbers start to go down, it becomes about the game again. And you know, I spent this week in Phoenix, Arizona, and I was interviewing for my day job. You know, I haven't spoken about this. I was interviewing a guy called Johnny Gomes, and Johnny Gomes is a baseball player, and he's not just a baseball player. His story is an incredible story of hardship growing up and talent, but most of all, dedication and hard work and humility. I mean, he's just an extraordinary human being, Rog. And I met him a year ago at an event in Montana, and I'd been wanting to go and interview him about his story ever since, and I did that this week. And we sort of sat and talked for 3 hours about his journey from, you know, no scholarship, from enlisting in the Marines and getting a call right before he was about to go and join the Marines from a scout saying, hey, there's a tryout. I want you to go and try out for the Major League Baseball. And him kind of going, well, I'm going to the Marines, and, you know, going to the draft, having the day of his life, in his own words, at the draft, and walking away going, I don't know who that guy was, but I feel bad for whoever drafts me because I can't do that again. And parlaying that into a rise through the multiple levels of baseball, ultimately to the World Series with the Boston Red Sox, hitting a 3-run homer to win a World Series game.
Oh, for goodness sake.
You know, yeah, winning it. And I've got a picture of me with the two, he won another one the 2 years later with the Kansas City Royals. So there's a picture of me with two World Series rings on my fingers. It's extraordinary. But his story is everything that sport is about, Rog. You know, the guy had talent, but he recognizes as he goes up the league to get the yawning chasms in talent from college to the pros, to single A ball, to triple A ball, to eventually getting into the major leagues. It's all about the game. For him, it's all about the game. And to hear him talk about the game and the discipline required to play the game, nothing about the trappings, nothing about, you know, what comes with it. And I think this is where we're going back to. We're going back to it being about the game. And I think that is a wholly positive thing.
Well,
I really do.
I'm not sure about that. And I'm not replay the whole stuff that we talk about for years. All I would say, I'd take us back to where you were the last time we spoke at the Masters. By the way, I loved the Masters this year for one reason. I had signed up in Birmingham to a sweepstake of 4 players, you know, and you know me, I carry a lot of luck. And I got Scheffler. I knew I wanted Scheffler. I knew I wanted Tyler, what's his name? What's he say? Hatton? Tyler Hatton, because I'd read...
Oh, Tyrrell Hatton, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. You know, so there you go. So, but I knew people said that he had the game for it, so I picked him. I liked Freddie Couples, because I always... Not Couples, Freddie Couples, what's his name? The guy in the orange. Good-looking guy.
Ricky Fowler.
Because I like him. And the fourth one, I swear, was a pin in the piece of paper, Straka, right? No, I'd never heard of him before. Right, but the point is, I'm doing well after 3 rounds and I'm leading this sweet space. There's a bit of money at stake here, you know? And so I'm really, this is the point. I was skinning the game, if you were, and winning it really well. And of course, Ricky and Tyler Hatton, both bogey 17 and 18, both of them. And like that eats my lead away because my main competitor's got Homa as well as Schaefer. So we had Schaefer together, he had Homa, I had Straka. So it really came down to those two. I was up in the other one. And so, you know, Homa at the 12th, you know, gets the 6 and I am loving it. And like, it's looking as if I'm going to bring it home. I've got a 1-point lead as the last group comes up the 18th. All I need is for American
Morikawa
to par and I win. And remember, I've just had two other ones that bogeyed 18 and 17. And he bogeys it, puts it in the trees and everything like that. Joint winner. Still got a fair bit of wedge. But, you know, 18th was painful for me. But my point is, I, for the first time, stayed up till 1:15 to watch this. It's years I've not done that. And I did it this year because I had a wee bit of a punt on it. But then I see this article, Grant, that says that the viewership on Sunday's final round was down 20%.
20%.
Tell
yeah.
me, what's happening there? Coming back to your thing about the game, the purity's going to win out.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty simple to me, and I've felt it, Rog, is that I was actually watching it in Napa with a great friend of mine who's the best golfer I've ever played with. We sat watching it, and when Ludwig stuck his approach to 11 in the pond, I said to him, this is over, Scheffler wins by 4 now. And he's like, no, come on, there's no way it's going to be closer than that. And it wasn't. And the reason the viewing figures were down was Scheffler's too good. He's too good.
I don't buy that, Grant.
And
I don't buy that.
Well, no, Rog, you know, we'll go into this. His numbers are, if he keeps going, better than Tiger's in some levels in terms of the quality of his golf, right? The thing is, there's no drama. he's too good. It's too solid. It's too steady. He doesn't make pars out the trees like Tiger used to. He doesn't make pars from his knees like Seve used to. He's just that good, right? And so once he gets the lead like that, there's no drama. And I think that's why, because I saw that about the figures too, and I was surprised, but then I thought about my own experience. I had to drive back from Napa into San Francisco, and I left my buddy Mark's house once he came through 11 and didn't stick his ball in the pond, because I knew he wouldn't make a mistake at 12. He just wouldn't make that mistake. I left and got in the car and listened to the rest on the radio because I knew it was over. And sure enough, Scheffler won by four, and it just wasn't dramatic, which the Masters always is. There's always lead changes. The winner drops back. Scheffler was never going to let go of that lead. And so, you know, look what he did at the Heritage the following week. You know, he's extraordinary. And that was great for golf when it was Tiger. But, you know, Tiger's dominance came with a massive amount of flair. And I think if you asked Eddie, he would just say to you, Scheffler is just so, so, so solid. He's the best ball striker. He's one of the best drivers of the ball. He's one of the best scramblers around the green if he gets in trouble. The only thing letting him down is his putting. And when you've got a guy who, if he putts okay, is going to be in the hunt every week, it's just not thrilling like Tiger was.
Well,
and that's a shame because Scheffler's an unbelievable golfer.
I love him for a million reasons. I love that guy.
But you know, Roger, what's interesting is something we've talked about. For you to do that, that shows you how important the gambling aspect is.
I was just going to come on to that. Gambling and fantasy.
Yeah, how important it is. Yeah.
You know, like, and this was another one I was going to, I'm really glad you said that because I was struggling for the segue there, but you gave it to me, one of the stories. A shout out to the wonderful FT newsletter that Dominic sends us every Saturday. You know, Josh Noble edits that, and it's just, I think it's a wonderful news. This comes from that, which is the story about betting in US sport, which, remember, the opening of the market, the great hope that everything was going to be okay in sports in America. Well, the scandals are now coming. Toronto Raptors point guard adopted the catchphrase, bet on yourself, to describe his unlikely rise, blah, 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 blah. His teammate, Raptors power forward Jonte Porter, took that advice a little bit too literally. This week, the NBA delivered a lifetime ban to Porter after they found him been wagering on basketball games this year, including limiting his own on-court performance to coincide with an acquaintance's 80 grand wager on his stats. I'll finish this with one little comment. I'm seeing a lot of decks these days about people trying to raise money around the opening of the American market, and they've been around for ages, these decks. I was on a call this week and, you know, I basically said, you really don't think there's going to be pushback from this? That there's going to be what I called political risk, that somebody says, enough is enough, and we're going to stop it before it's too late. Betting in America, that story, I think, is starting to smell a little bit off.
Yeah, I mean, the other big story in the States is Shohei Ohtani, who's a massive star in Major League Baseball, and playing for the Dodgers, and all these bets have come up that his interpreter is being charged with stealing $16 million from Ohtani and him gambling it. Now, there's a lot of smoke around this story, Rog, and Major League Baseball, I suspect, would go an awful long way, let's just say, to
bury the story.
How can we put this? Let's say that Major League Baseball will be incredibly grateful if this didn't turn out to be one of their biggest stars gambling on the game. But it's inevitable that we're going to see this, right? We've talked about this a lot, the gambling, the rise of gambling and what it does. You know, one of the greatest baseball players of all time, Pete Rose, still is not in the Hall of Fame. You know, he must be in his 70s now, I think. Hasn't made it into the Hall of Fame, the guy with more hits than anybody, because he was found guilty of gambling on baseball. Not his own games, again, but back in the day. And this is a guy who, you know, is one of the biggest stars in the game of baseball. He's not in the Hall of Fame yet. And so I guess the one thing for me that we're going to perhaps see is Pete Rose gets into the Hall of Fame finally, because there's going to be so much stuff around gambling that it's going to be impossible to keep him out of the Hall of Fame now. But yeah, the gambling stuff, Major League Sports in America is just getting started, Roger, and I think there's going to be plenty.
It's such a difficult one.
Of bad stories coming out.
It's such a difficult one because the point is that I did watch the Masters because I had a little bet on it. And I do watch the Premiership principally because of the fantasy. And that's driving my sports consumption. Let's come back to the Premiership, man, because do we have a lot to talk about there?
Yes, we do.
I'm going to kick you off with you asking your view on the whole ref situation. You've been on VAR for a while. So let's talk about Coventry and that goal. Let's talk about Nottingham Forest and their press release. And then I've got a little curveball at the end from Italy on refs. So tell me your thoughts. You're the man, you're the everyman, that football fan that we all want to hear about. What's the situation with VAR?
Okay, I think the kind of the TLDR, as the kids say, Royce, the too long didn't read, is it's a great idea implemented about as poorly as it's possible to implement it. That, I think, sums up VAR. I think it could be a tremendous force for good in the game, but it shocks me, actually, how poorly it's been implemented and the number of mistakes that have been made and the number of controversies it's thrown up. It's astounding to me. And, of course, the idea of bringing in technology-based adjudications that are ultimately in the hands of people mean the same thing as when they're in the hands of people. You're going to get the human frailties and the human flaws and they're going to make mistakes. It's that simple. And that's what we've seen, except when the mistakes are being made without technology, people accept them as human. When they're made around the implementation of that technology, well, this is not supposed to happen because we have technology. So this was kind of always going to happen. The Coventry one, look.
Tragic.
I think.
Utterly tragic.
It was so close, right? It was so close, but they're saying it was offside. Now, it's so close that we don't know the exact split second that contact was made with the ball. Right, so they're freeze framing it when it looks like the guy's foot is hitting the ball, making the pass forward. We don't know when the lines are that close. They were basically on top of each other, Rog, the two lines, right? And it turned red. It to me, it comes down to clear and obvious error. And I think when they look at these things, it should be a case of, look, is it possible that there's no way you could have seen that with the naked eye? It should carry on, you know, it should be allowed. But then you go back and say, look, that's the romantic in me who would love to have seen Coventry come from 3-0 down to beat Man United 4-3 in an FA Cup semi-final and get to Wembley. That would have been one of the great FA Cup stories
Grant,
of all time.
It's not the romantic. It's something different. And a few people have called it out, much to my delight. Proper football fans know when there's a penalty, know when there's a red card,
and
they know when there's an offside. What is different now? Everything you said is correct, but there's something bigger. You know, when I dealt with referees in my time, I always found them to be, in the main, great pragmatists. You know, like, they had deep down an understanding of what I've just talked about. You know, regardless of the rules of the game, they would use what we know as common sense. Technology has, whether deliberately or not, ripped away the common sense from the game. And for that Coventry comeback, which would have gone into the annals, along with Hereford United and John Radford and all of that kind of stuff,
yeah, absolutely,
to be robbed from all of us, not just Coventry fans, to be robbed from all of us, is criminal. It's criminal negligence. And, you know, the one from Nottingham Forest where I want to link this to it, where, you know, Gary Neville saying Clattenburg should resign for being associated. Well, no, the people who should be thinking about resigning are the one, I don't know, what's it called, PGLOA, I don't know what it's called. The one,
PGMOL, yeah.
Yeah, the ones in charge of referees in England after a year like this should all, Japanese style, walk to the window in their office and jump out, because it has been an unmitigated disaster this season. And Coventry has been so bad that, you know, I think there's no case for the defence anymore.
Well, it's a difficult one, Rog, because the solution, let's face it, is a radical overhaul. And that radical overhaul is, let's keep the technology that says the ball's over the line or not. That's great. Right. And that's been fantastic in terms of the goals it's said happened and didn't happen. Terrific. And then everything else, and I mean everything else, has to be up for grabs. Is it a good idea? I know that's what you want. I know we're moving to automated offsides, which for me, fine, right?
Fine.
They have the technology now, I'm sure, to put chips in the toe caps of every football boot on the field and make it that. Just make it, never mind this shoulder and shirt sleeve and all that bollocks. Your furthest toe forward, it's football after all.
Well done.
Should
well
determine
said.
Where the offside is. Right? And that's really simple. Every fan can understand that. We're not looking to see if his armpit is slightly over the line. There's none of that cobblers. Yeah, and you can automate it. That's fine. But I think the longer they make it as complicated as it is, and the longer they continue to debate and go into all these decisions, they're killing the spontaneity of the game, and they're killing the enjoyment of it for the fans. And ultimately, as we say at the top of every show, it's the most important thing is the fans' enjoyment of it. And look, you know, it's great to have stuff to talk about down the pub after the game. And we said this at the very beginning of VAR, but it should be, Can you believe the referee missed the offside? The Coventry one hurt
because that that's a page in the history book. No longer there.
Yeah,
I
agree. That would have been one of the all-time great results.
Yeah,
you know, what, it absolutely would have been, and Man United fans would have been up in arms, but they'd have gotten over it. They'd have been fuming for a couple of years every time the FA Cup came around. They'd be, well, what about the time we were robbed? That's part of what football's about.
Yeah. You know, the one I referred to, Nottingham Forest, this was them coming out after a game that may cost them relegation, saying, we told you guys that the guy in the VAR was a Luton fan, Luton being one of their competitors for relegation, and they had a lot of decisions went against them. So an official club statement went out basically saying, you had a guy who was biased in there, we told you about it, you did nothing about it. And they have on their board this ex-referee, Clattenburg, who I'm not sure who he is really. But anyway, the world of football from Carragher to Neville to Alan Shearer has gone very heavy and saying this was an atrocious statement. And I'm not sure it was, you know. Given what we've just said the last 5 minutes, I think people need to start getting what is called not professional, speaking like a fan, getting angry, because sometimes it's the only way to change things, by rattling cages and becoming a real pain in the neck. In some ways, I say, well done, Nottingham Forest. I know nobody else agrees, but I'm going to take that line, Grant.
I take your point, and I see the validity of it. I have a problem when you see these people saying, well, of course, we know that no one's biased. Everyone's biased for some reason or another, right? But the real pros put that behind them and do their jobs. I didn't agree with Forrest coming out and saying the guy's a Luton fan and making the implications they did. I don't think that's fair on him, Rog. I really don't. But it's about accountability. It's about the PGMOL releasing the audio and being proactive about it and saying, look, there's a controversy here. Here's the process. And it comes back to what we talked about before, miking the refs up, right? Which I think would be, if you're going to do this, let's be transparent about it. Let's if you're going to say we're going to show everything on the screen so you can see it, let's hear the deliberations. Let's see how professional these guys are. Let's hear the process. So I didn't take kindly to that Forrest statement, Roger.
I knew you wouldn't.
I think had it been issued... No, look, I get it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not castigating the guy for doing it. I just think had he waited 24 hours before sending that, he wouldn't have sent that. I think that was in the heat of the moment.
The juice is in the impulsiveness that's sport.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
If we're all going to become German Swiss in our attitudes to getting angry.
Yeah, well, you're at the other end of the spectrum in Italy, right?
Well, let me tell you about this Italian one because everything's relative, man. Everything's relative.
Always.
Italian head of refs, no longer, but he was. convicted of 5 years in jail for drug trafficking. The guy's name is Donofrio. He was the ex-head of referees of the Italian Association of Arbitrary Referees. The article, this is the beautiful stuff in Italy, it doesn't even get in the front page in the sports page. It's like page 20, something like this. Drug trafficking. At the trial, his sentence was reduced thanks to his contribution and openness in helping the investigations. But now the overall total of his conviction is up to 8 years because it's added on to a previous one he's got for other drug trafficking. So seriously, let's think about this. This guy was major in charge of referees in Italy. He's a drug trafficker. Fixing a game, ain't that a big moral issue for this guy?
No, this is very true. This is very true.
Yeah, I've got another one for Italy that's nothing to do with referees, but since we're in Italy and we're having a laugh.
Go on.
You know, the whole thing about women's football, you know, I did the article last week about Como women and Vitoire from Mercury 13 and how she's bought Como.
Yeah.
All super stuff, right? All of which I believe and absolutely true. Last night in the third division of women's football in Italy, there was a thing at the end of the game, six players sent off. This is the women's third division. You know, they were swinging at each other. It was pretty good to see, actually. And that would have been fine until one of the coaches, a man, comes on and starts laying into them. He knocks one of the girls down. Oh, I mean, there's the video. I mean, like, so the whole world is, like, all over this in Italy, you know, like, rightly so. I mean, like, when do you ever hit a woman? Never. Anyway, you know, the point is, women's football, without him, six get sent off at the end of the game. It's getting tasty. Values will be going up. There's hope.
Well, there you go, right. There's the flip side. The flip side. Well, listen, I want to go back to golf for a goal, and that was Ludwig Auber. You know, this young kid, this is the first major he's played in, right? He's number nine in the world. He's never played in a major championship. He's been part of a winning Ryder Cup team. He's won one event in the PGA Tour and I think two in Europe. This kid is unbelievable, Rog. To see him, not only how he played, you know, to finish solo second in the Masters and to be in the thick of that battle, but he was completely unflappable. You know, he dumped his approach in the pond on 11, which is a mistake that, you know, Tiger and Jack have said, that's a mistake. You never, ever go near that pond. You knock it 40 yards right and chip with the green if you have to. He made a rookie mistake. You didn't see his shoulders drop. You didn't see his demeanor change. He was still smiling with his caddy. He was still focused. This kid is going to be an absolute juggernaut. There's something about him. His swing is
beautiful,
as close to perfection as you can get with a golf club in your hand. I was just blown away. I was a huge fan before, having kind of followed his amateur career and after we did the Ryder Cup. But to see how he performed under the pressure of, you know, challenging for the lead and being tied for the lead on the back nine on Sunday in the Masters, say one bad shot cost him.
And I agree with that.
There are so many experienced pros who can say that, but he was remarkable. And then you know, back to this idea of equality, Rog, you know, what Nelly Korda is doing on the LPGA Tour is astounding. You know, to win five in a row, including the major championship
Chevron
this week.
Good you brought that up.
Under that pressure. Incredible. And her swing is absolutely
They've got great swings as well. You know, I want them to play together. Oh. That's the future of golf. It needs to be, find a way for the handicaps and everything, like the distance thing, strength. The future of golf is men and women teeing off at the same time on the same tournament. I'm convinced of that, Grant.
We can agree on that. Yeah, we can absolutely agree on that. But you know what was interesting, Roger? I was listening to the chipping forecast, you know, with Eddie, Andrew Cotter, and your old mate Ian Carter. And what Ian Carter had to say, it was astounding. You know, he went from Augusta National to the Woodlands in Houston to cover the Chevron. He said he was the only mainstream golf journalist who went to the Chevron. there were the beat reporters for the LPGA tour. He said, but he was the only guy who went to that. Everyone else went to the RBC Heritage and just continued the men's tour. So that shows you the challenge that women's golf is up against, even with the likes of Nelly Korda and Rose Zhang and Lydia Ko. They've got some tremendous talents on that tour, but they're up against it because the ratings aren't there, and neither is the journalistic coverage, which is a great shame because Nelly Korda's making history.
It is such a hard thing because the cultural side of sport being the refuge of the working class man all around the world, that is refuge, and it is his refuge after him working to bring money back into the household where the woman would be looking after the household. That's a 100-year culture, 150-year culture.
Yeah,
it's
great point.
It's not going to change no matter how much you want it to change. And again, coming back to, the big theme of popular delusion and the madness of crowds, you can't say these things, but maybe you can these days. I saw a clip from NASCAR on Twitter, and you saw that one. Okay, right. So what it's like, the NASCAR audience, you see a lot of these petrolheads, their demographic, and there's girls on the stage. I think they're fans or wives. I don't know what they are. They don't seem to be like hostesses.
Fans, they're just fans.
Fans, yeah. They're getting their tops off and they're swinging around the thing and the guys are loving it. And, it looks like Hooters. And no matter how much you want that to change, it's not going to change. This is a refuge for a certain type of guy who wants to blow off steam and think about a nice girl. And we need to recognise that and not be blinded by what the culture war tells us we should think and we should market to. NASCAR is that audience there. That audience there. And NFL is that audience there. And the golf audience, I'm afraid to say, is guys are your demographic, Grant. It's who it is. And you're going to follow the guys' game. You're not going to follow...
Define my demographic, Roger, just so I know.
Well, I can go as specific as you want. You're male, you're 50 plus, you're white, you've above average earnings. How much further do you want me to go? Play the game himself... that's golf. That's the golf.
All right. I thought you were going to boil it down to male, pale, and stale. So I'll take that.
Well, that is how that's described as a slogan. But yes, this thing, popular delusion that just by willing it, women's sport is going to succeed is wrong. And then when you think about how they've given them such a handicap with this trans stuff as well, talk about shooting themselves in the foot. Anyway. Let's not go into that one.
All right, well, what else you got for me?
Well, I'm going to stay on the Ludwig thing, just very briefly. Bellingham winning the Clásico there, what can you say about this guy? I know we've said it before, but, honestly, you just got to say, who the hell are you? Are you Superman? Are you an alien? It's unbelievable.
Yeah. The incredible thing is he's doing it on the pitch and off the pitch, Rog. That's the remarkable thing. I presume you saw that clip. With
astounding
with Rio.
Yeah, astounding.
They had Bellingham pitch side after the game, still in his Real Madrid shirt, sweat dripping off him, talking about the game, and talking about it in a way that, you have to see it to really believe it. Considering he's 20 years old, the composure. The understanding, the balance, it's incredible. And Rio Ferdinand says, "Who the hell are you?" He said, "Who the hell are you?"
Yeah, yeah.
You can't be 20 years old the way you handle everything. And even that didn't faze him, Rog. Even that didn't faze him. He turned it back on to Ancelotti and how he helps the boys understand. He is, again, like Ludwig, Bellingham is going to be, I think, by far the biggest player in the world.
I think he already is. I think by a country
but he,
mile.
But again, he doesn't yet have Neymar's reputation or Mbappe's reputation because he's not all over social media and making a big deal of himself. I think that will come. Be interesting to see what happens. And I presume he's fought that off thus far because you would have thought it would happen already. So fair play to him or whoever's handling him. But in terms of, is he the best player? it's a tough one to argue that he isn't. He just isn't the most widely fated. No, yeah, let's put it that way.
I don't care about that. We're football fans. You know, there's enough. Let's come on to what we put a flag into earlier. You know, Man United, I think, balked at the price of 30 million when he was still at Birmingham City, Bellingham. And this takes you on to this theme that I've been having for a long time now about there's just so much money wasted at certain clubs. You know, Man United, you could go through them and you basically say, who do you want to keep as opposed to who do you want to get rid of in that squad? It is shambolic, totally shambolic. Chelsea last night, I think, I don't know by the time this goes out, I guess Poch will have gone, but it's not really his fault. You know, the people they brought in on 8 years contracts, no thinking about gelling or putting together a dressing room that's coordinated and coherent. You know, I've seldom seen in my career this quantum of money, capital, being wasted by the people running Man United and Chelsea. Seldom seen it. And, you know, when you see English teams, not in any longer in the Champions League, the only one in any competition is Aston Villa, who, by the way, is coached by a guy that was discarded by English football. Good evening, you know, Emery. I'm telling you, I keep saying this, and people...
Unai, not Dick, right?
Yes. People are not listening enough. English football, for all its money, is managed and operated at the mean incredibly badly. They make horrendous decisions over managers and player recruitment every day that's costing, at this point, hundreds of millions. And then still they talk about, you know, how do we grow the top line? It's not about the top line. It's about missing all of those, what I would call 100 million plus errors. And the way to do that is to get your A's and A pluses in your leadership. Anyway, I don't think it's a great moment for English football.
Well, Rog, I think when you point to Man United and Chelsea particularly, I think the change there has been, they've always spent money, those clubs, but they had spent them building successful teams. What they're doing now is desperation because success is expected of them. And so they are throwing money at any quick fix. You know, there's no long-term plan. There's no dialogue with the fans saying, look, we could be shite for a couple of years, but we're going to build a good team. They don't have that latitude, right? So they've always spent the money. It's just got, you know, Chelsea have always spent money, but they did it in a constructive way. And now they're doing it in a desperate way. They're just throwing money at people that,
a lot
that,
of money.
That they think might make a difference. And it's incredible, actually. I mean, that Arsenal game, I mean, you know, you look at Arsenal grinding results out against lower teams and getting beaten by Villa, and they go and thump Chelsea, who just didn't even turn up, 5-0.
They don't care. Too many don't care. Like the Casemiro penalty.
I mean, just remarkable.
Unbelievable. Listen, I've got an own goal, probably my main own goal. Did you see that Cardiff City are suing Nantes for an amount of money they've quantified, $120 million? Remember that poor soul player, Salah, who was transferred from one to the other, then was put on a plane that was not in regulation, and he went down and died.
One
of the real...
I've forgotten this story. Yeah.
This is the point. Everybody's forgotten this story, much to the disgrace of our industry. That is one of the real sad moments, also about how it was dealt with and, you know, how they tried to work out whose player it was and who gets compensated. Well, anyway, now Cardiff, owned by, was that guy Vincent Hahn, that you know, the owner, Looney Tune to the max, Vincent Hahn, right? He has employed a company called Analytics FC. If that's wrong, forgive me, because I want to get this slap down very correct. I believe it's Analytics FC, who, through their use of the usual data and probabilities, have come up with the chance that Salah not being there cost them relegation, a certain percentage, and they've put a number on that with modelling and all this, at $120 million. seriously, Analytics FA, how the fuck can you take that assignment on and sleep at night? This is a guy who's died and his family, who knows. You say to Vincent Hahn, go and fuck yourself with that assignment, because you that blood money will always be on your hands. That's how strongly I feel about that, Grant.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it, Rog. That's astounding. I mean, I'm shocked. I mean, really, I haven't seen the story, and I'll dig it up and read it. But that's what is there to say about that? It's not. It's indefensible. Unfortunately,
Vincent Hahn, we know he's a nut job, and one of the things that a regulator probably should try and do about, you know, fit and proper test. But the analytics company that did that work need to have a serious, serious look at themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Amen. I've got nothing to say to that. While we're on the subject of football, Rog, one more story that actually seemed to be fairly quietly under the radar was Wrexham getting promoted again.
Was under the radar.
You know, it didn't get the kind of splash that I would have expected it to, which is just interesting to note. We'll see if, you know, that is becoming less of a story now because they're successful. I don't know. But for them to do what they've done, again, you know, to go from non-league football and then two promotions in a row, get into League One next year, is, again, it's a fantastic story. And, you know, I've been on record of saying what a fan I am of McIlhenny and Reynolds. With the new season of Welcome to Wrexham debuts, I think, next week. So I'll be looking forward to following that. I hope season two was a bit disappointing because Reynolds and McIlhenny weren't in it very much. So I didn't find it as engaging because they're very, very funny and very good value. We'll see what the third season is. But the story continues, and it's just a fantastic story, Rog. You know, whatever you think about it, whether you think they've bought success, they put some money into the club, they've taken them this far, they're probably going to have to put a lot more money into the club now, so we'll see what happens. It's going to be, I think it gets more interesting from here rather than less.
Yeah. But it's funny that what you were just saying, the second season, not interesting. Alternative heading. Story about nothing club doesn't get viewers when the Hollywood stars are not there. Let's be honest.
Look, it was still a great story. Don't get me wrong. I still followed the story. I followed them last year because I wanted to see how they did. So the story was great, but just the TV show aspect of it, it wasn't as engaging.
Of course.
Without those two in it, because they were
the
just, they brought the heart
the
and the humour to
the TV show,
it.
The whole thing, the whole project's about the documentary that went along with it. But anyway,
I don't know if I agree with that, Rog. I don't know if I agree with that, but anyway, but I was surprised that they went up again without as much being made of it this time.
I've got a couple of quick ones. I don't know if you're short of time or not.
Go on.
Listen, the whole story about AC Milan and more importantly, Inter Milan. Inter Milan won the league this year in the derby at the San Siro. I think that's the first time that's ever happened. So that was their 20th title, which means the second star. So it's a big, big title to win, the 20th one. It's incredibly unusual that you do it against your rival. And the pain of AC Milan is endless at this moment in time. And I know it's a serious issue. It's a serious issue because I keep coming back to all these people investing in Italian football and they really don't, I don't think they get it. I think, and I'm sorry if I'm going to have a wee bit of a go at Jerry here because I think he basked very much in the luck of them winning the league as soon as he bought it. And it's been proven that that was a bit of a fluke because that squad and that manager, Pioli, are not up to it. And I think Jerry didn't realise what he got himself into, to be honest, and you know, forget the fact that he paid way over the odds for that club. I think this will be seen as a pain point for Redbird going forward. I'm sorry if Jerry doesn't like that, but that's what I think. The point is that in Italian football, the derby is very important. Pioli lost, if I'm not mistaken, six in a row against Inter Milan. That's death sentence. As it was for Mourinho, who, despite all his success at Roma, lost, I think, four derbies in a row or didn't win in four derbies.
To Lazio, yeah.
To Lazio, and you know, he's gone as well. The Italian football is very, very much like that. And the pain, you know, I'm just up the road from Milan, the pain on the red and black side of the city to see the others win their 20th league, which I think is more than Milan's won in total, against them and rub it in their face on the pitch at the end of the 90 minutes is just as bad as it gets, Grant. As bad as it gets. And I think I merited an own goal or a goal, whatever you want to call it.
You know, the fact that you describe it as endless pain tells you just how important it is to Italian fans, right? We think of it, endless pain. The other team won. Yeah, that's cause for endless pain.
Yeah, right. I'm one against you. Listen, on that, I've got a pretty funny one to finish. Are you following Matt Letizia's new incarnation as a personality? Are you following that?
Did I tell you, I played golf with him. I played golf with him last year.
What?
I played in a golf competition, and he was in my flight. Him and his partner. We had a terrific time. It was fantastic. We had such a good time. We played him in a 9-hole match, and we beat him. Me and my partner gave him a good thrashing, actually, as it happens. But we had a terrific time. It couldn't have been nicer.
Right. You know.
So yes, but I am aware of the other stuff.
Well, the other stuff being that. This is this beautiful tweet. Letizia has gone into that world that I think certain things are all the same. Climate denier, COVID was a bluff, the viruses kill you.
I believe they call it a conspiracy theorist, Rog.
Conspiracy theorist, but of things that I think are common enough that you can get away with in a dinner party. You know, and there's this wonderful tweet from this guy, Michael Normanton. Chapeau, Michael. He's put this on. I think in this clip you can see that Matthew Letizia knows it's all gone horribly wrong. He just wanted someone to agree with his shit theories about COVID, and now he's listening to a man talking about Johan Cruyff being in witness protection and the resurrection of Princess Diana on November the 5th. So you see this video close up of him, and you hear the other guys. Grant, it's worse than you're imagining in your head now, because this guy,
I've
seen it. This guy's basically saying Johan Cruyff played with number 14. He originally died on this day. If you add these numbers together and divide it by two, which was the number of sons he had, it comes out at 365. 365 is the number of witness protection. And you see Letizia's face, and it's like, you can see, I'm in the wrong movie here. I'm in the wrong movie. And then this guy comes up with other numbers. You know, these people, I don't know, it's like Carl Vorderman, you know, and that countdown stuff, you know, the numbers. And then the number comes up that Lady Diana is going to reappear on November the 5th and tell everything, tell the truth. You should see his face. So Michael Normanton, for the quote above that video, is chapeau, absolutely chapeau.
Well, I tell you what, Rog, if Princess Di had wanted to hide all this time, she could have been playing for Southampton. No one would have known where she was. That's terrific. I'll have to look out for that.
I will send you that straight away. Yeah.
Yeah, send that out. Send that out. But mate, that's it. We've done it. We've gone over an hour. Yeah, it's flown by. And I have to say, I was dragging this morning. I'm incredibly jet lagged. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be tough. But as always,
Gog is Gog, man.
As always.
Gog is Gog.
You've made it. You've made it an incredibly enjoyable hour that zipped by. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And of course, our thanks to you out there for listening to us. It's two old men screaming at clouds, as I keep saying, if you're not listening to us. So we appreciate you doing that. If you don't follow us on social media, there's only one way to do that, but it's a pretty simple one. You can find us on Twitter at EntertainedR. That's the word A-R-E. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
And myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. All right, my friend. Take care. Andiamo.
Ciao, ciao. Ciao.